Hello and thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this podcast we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Give our Facebook page a like and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. There are show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and please do rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it, which helps more people find it. Remember, if you haven't already, do consider signing up to become a Turkey Book Talk member for exclusive extras and help us keep going. Joining our growing list of signed up members gets you transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. You also get transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 80 conversations and which includes a number of extra interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to an exclusive discount deal, a whopping 35% off the cover price of books published in IB Taurus's extensive Turkey and Ottoman history category. IB Taurus, which is now part of Bloomsbury, has well over 400 books in its Turkey and Ottoman history series, including both academic and general interest titles. Turkey Book Talk members receive a special code for a 35% discount on books in that series, including physical books, pre-orders and ebooks, and indeed the deal actually includes the title that we're discussing in this episode. Last but not least, members also receive an archive of 231 book reviews written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East and Europe. That archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. To become a member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. New episodes go out every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get cracking with our latest episode. In it, we speak to Patrick Kedi. He's the author of The Passion, Football and the Story of Modern Turkey, which, as I just mentioned, is published by IB Taurus. The book is a very interesting exploration of the central place of the beautiful game in Turkish society, politics, culture, and history. It sees Kedi traveling the length and breadth of the country, speaking to fans, administrators, players, and officials, and the book includes chapters on some knotty issues, including Syrian refugees in Turkey, African migrant footballers, women's football, homophobia, corruption, match rigging, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's relationship with the game. By coincidence, the book came out around the same time as John McManus's book on Turkish football called Welcome to Hell. We actually published a Turkey Book Talk episode on that one too last year, if you want to delve into the archives, but I started by asking Patrick Kedi whether it was a bit annoying that the two books came out around the same time.
It wasn't annoying. I mean, it was great, actually, that John was working on his book, because it kind of shows that I'm not just sort of one anorak interested in Turkish football by myself. You know, it shows that it's kind of a legitimate field of inquiry. I think our books are slightly different. Mine is maybe, I don't know, like sociological in a way. His is more of an anthropological book. His has more like kind of memoir elements to it, because he spent a lot longer in Turkey than I did. So I think there are differences, but there's a lot of parallels as well in it. Turkish football is, it has so many interesting elements to it, and it's a very valid area of inquiry.
And how did you get into the subject? I mean, when did you arrive in Turkey, and how did you go about researching the book? I mean, I was struck as I was reading it, you utilize a very wide, impressive network of contacts that inform all the chapters.
Yeah, I think I could trace the genesis of the book back to 2013 with the Gezi protests. So I was actually living in Egypt at the time, and I was following the protests from afar, and I was very intrigued to see all the different fans, the Besiktas, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray fans, putting aside their mutual loathing and kind of uniting on the street in those protests. So over time, I was just starting to do more research, and I was sort of discovering just how bound up Turkish football is in politics and culture and Turkish society. So, I was kind of discovering that Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was an ex-semi-professional footballer, and that he was using the sport in terms of his rhetoric, and that football was a huge kind of network of power in Turkey, and football fans were very involved in activism and then protest in the stadiums in the afternoon. aftermath of the Gezi protests. I visited Istanbul for the first time in 2014. I wanted to go to a football match, but I was unable to because of this Pasalig identity card that had just been introduced. So, and this was like a very contentious issue while I was there, and there were all these kind of protests on the streets, and these football fans were coming together again to kind of protest this card, which they saw as a way to stop them kind of being political in the stadiums. And also it's kind of run by a pro-government bank, so it's fed into this kind of patronage network. So I visited Turkey again in early 2015, and I wrote a couple of stories about Turkish football. One of them was about, is Turkish football going to collapse? Because it was like one of the periodic times of crisis in Turkish football then, financial, and there was a bit of crowd violence going on and stuff like that. And another story was about a football team that was closed down after the 1980 military coup because of its name. It was basically considered an affront to Turkish national values. So the longer I worked on the project, the more I realized I had the kind of book length project, and I was lucky enough to get a publishing deal in 2015. So I moved to the country in the summer of 2015, which was quite a sort of fraught time with there was no government at that period. There was a war between the ceasefire between the Kurdish movement and the government had broken down. There was a lot of tension in the air. So I wanted to write a kind of sweeping account of Turkish football because it hadn't been done in book length before, which was, for me, that was quite surprising because Turkish football is quite important. It's got like the sixth largest broadcasting revenues in Europe. Turkey finished third in the 2002 World Cup. Galatasaray has won the UEFA Cup, and Turkish fans are considered among the most passionate in European football. And yeah, I wanted to use football as a lens to explore and tell all these stories about Turkish culture and identity, politics, because Turkish football is so bound up in these elements. I wanted to focus on basically the AKP's time in power. I wanted to go back in history where relevant, but I wanted to focus basically on the 21st century because it's been such a transformational time in Turkish life and society. So yeah, I just tried to travel around the country as much as possible, just meet as many different people as possible, fans, players, administrators, you know, coaches, and just kind of ask them, you know, what football means to them, how they kind of live their lives through football, what football reveals about them. And I wanted to just kind of let them speak as much as possible because cultural reportage has been quite neglected in Turkey and you don't tend to hear these voices too much. So I'm not much of a character in the book. Yeah, so I just tried to gather as many stories as possible. So I ended up covering Kurdish teams kind of struggling to play amid conflict, a story about a gay referee, a story about Syrian refugees who were formerly paid for the Syrian national team and now are living in a refugee camp, trying to set up a kind of alternative Syrian national team, women playing football and kind of fighting for their rights through football, and loads of other stories as well. So with contacts, I just had to plug away at it, really. I didn't have any real contacts before I first came to Turkey. I just had to rely on a lot of people helping me out, really. I mean, there hadn't been a book in English on Turkish football, but there had been like quite a big body of academic work done by Turkish academics in English on football over the previous 10, 15 years. So a lot of their work really helped me, and individually they helped me as well with contacts, and it kind of grew from there.
There's a quote in the book that I thought was very on point. You're speaking to a journalist in one bit, and he says, "In Turkey, we don't love football. We love our teams. We want our teams to be successful, nothing more." And I think that chimes actually with what I found here quite a bit. It seems like most people are more obsessed with the club than the game itself. I'm always surprised, like when there's a World Cup and Turkey's not involved, there's not really that much interest, for example. I don't know. Do you think that's a fair point or not?
I don't quite agree with that. I think there's an element of truth to it. Certainly, I think people are in Turkey, they tend to love their club and they tend to be so passionate about it. And it almost, that identity almost transcends everything else, whether it's even like kind of Turkish nationalism or their religion or whatever. I don't know. On the other hand, football is such, in general, football is such a kind of lingua franca, and you can have conversations all over the world with people about football. And, you know, it's a cultural phenomenon. It's by far the most, you know, important sport. And it's the sport with like the most money washing around it. And I think in Turkey in particular, that's particularly the case. I've had so many different conversations with people, not just about their particular clubs, but about quite obscure English clubs. Like I mostly grew up in Reading, and most Turkish people I speak to, they tend to have heard of Reading because of Reading Football Club. So they, in general, there is, I think, quite a deep knowledge and a deep affinity with different football clubs. The guy that runs my Tekel, he's a Fenerbahce fan, but he's also a massive Tottenham fan. So every time time ago in there. We have, I don't know, we kind of commiserate, I guess, recently. But yeah, we have a lot of conversations about different kinds of football clubs. And it's always the same with taxi drivers as well. And yeah, there is a sense that people, of course, they prize their own clubs above all else. And for a lot of people, these clubs are like a family to them. And it's a community and they want to be part of it. And I think that's particularly strong in Turkey. It's a very communitarian culture. But I don't know, on the other hand, yeah, they know a lot about kind of obscure players and obscure clubs as well.
We mentioned John McManus's book. One of the things that struck me as I read yours is that it's perhaps a little bit more political. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I do think it's fair to say. I think it had to be political. I mean, I think through the whole time I was walking this line between politics and football. And I think the book can be enjoyed by anyone that's interested in football and anyone that's interested in Turkish politics. But sometimes it was a bit of a difficult balancing act. So I just tried to make sure that any politics I included was directly tied to football. And yeah, as I say, I was there from 2015. It was a highly fraught and politicized time. So I guess I was caught up in a lot of that feeling and that atmosphere, and a lot of that ended up in the book. I think politics is so important in Turkey. Everything is politicized in Turkey, not just football, so that kind of had to be there. And I didn't want it to just be a pure football book, because I don't think that would really reflect what was going on, and it wouldn't be that insightful for readers as well. Yeah, some of my opinions are in there probably, and some of them are maybe between the lines, but I tried to speak to as many different people as possible. There's a lot of different kinds of fans and people from across the political spectrum in there. So I really tried to just get everyone's perspective.
Yes, indeed. I mean, politics are very difficult to avoid, really, when it comes to Turkish football. And probably the main example of that will be recognised internationally, perhaps, at the moment, is this story of Başakşehir, who are top of the league at the moment, top of the Turkish Super League, and look on course to win the league this year. And they've really come out of nowhere, really. The reason that they're political is because they're seen as this, basically, an AKP government project club. And I think at the time of recording this, they're, I think, 6 points clear of Galatasaray. And you've actually written quite a bit about Başakşehir. Could you just talk about that whole project, how it came about, what makes Başakşehir different from other clubs, and why are they controversial, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, a lot of fans, they kind of describe them as a government project team, and I think it's quite hard to argue against that. I mean, they started off as a municipality team. They were actually merged, three municipality teams were merged in 1990. One of those teams was İETT Tespor, a transport authority team that Erdogan used to play for.
Istanbul municipality, isn't it?
Istanbul municipality, yeah. So they started life as an Istanbul municipality team, and they didn't really have any success until Göksel Gümüşdağ kind of became their president. And he's very close to President Erdogan. He's related to him by marriage. I think he's married to Erdogan's wife's niece. And yeah, over this time, this club has just come from nowhere, basically, from having 30 or 40 fans playing in the lower divisions to being top of the league. And there was quite a decisive point in 2014 where it split from the municipality and it became a private entity, which is very rare in Turkish football. Most clubs are associations that are owned by members. And Başakşehir, it changed its name. It was called Istanbul Municipality Club before that. It rebranded to Başakşehir, relocated in Başakşehir, which is a outlying kind of pro-government stronghold. And they had a new stadium built for them by a pro-government company in a very short amount of time, which doesn't normally happen in Turkish football. Normally stadiums take forever to build. And the owners were all people kind of linked to the government, mainly business owners, or were also, a lot of them also involved in the municipality and have direct links to Erdogan. So Erdogan has kind of been he's been their most high profile supporter. I mean, he played in the opening exhibition match in the stadium, and he scored quite an incredible hat trick amid some
fantastic performance.
Yeah, it was one of the goals was really good, actually. I think it led Daily Sabah to liken him to Lionel Messi. But yeah, so he's used the club in his like political speeches and in his political like symbolism as well. I mean, he played in that match wearing the number 12, and that was just before the 12 presidential elections, and the club retired that number. And he speaks about them a lot, basically chastising the fans for not turning up in big enough numbers, and directly linking the club to the AKP's kind of struggle circles in culture, really, because he said in some speeches when he's been talking about Başakşehir, you know, the AKP, it can kind of dominate politics, but it's less dominant in the kind of cultural sphere. And so he sees Başakşehir as part of this push to extend the cultural sort of softer power and brand of the AKP. And yeah, they do get a lot of criticism. They don't have that many fans. They have just over kind of 4,000 people going to the matches. But from the other hand, I mean, they argue that Başakşehir is a huge neighborhood. It has a massive population. Why shouldn't the neighborhood have a thriving football team? They built a lot of pitches and places for like young people to play football. And they're really pushing the kind of education side of their program as well. They're putting a lot of people through these courses in business and sports management and stuff like that. So they kind of defend themselves as a community club, but it's also very much a top-down enterprise from the government, I think, as well. And it looks like they will win the league. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens, because, I mean, they would only be the fifth team ever to have won the Turkish top league, and they really don't have many fans. So it'll be interesting to see if this provokes some kind of existential crisis among other fans.
And one thing that you referred to a bit earlier was this ownership system that really does distinguish Başakşehir, because it's basically a private company now, and it's owned, I mean, we say it's a pro-government club, but it's owned, I mean, in theory, it's owned as a private entity owned by private business interests. Obviously, they're closely linked to the government, but that actually, in a way, is a more sustainable system of managing a club. In a way, it allows them to plan further ahead. And you make the point in the book that other clubs in Turkey tend to be owned on these, using these kind of association style rules, where you have to, where all the members, also fans, elect a president every few years, and this leads to a lot of short termism, a lot of debt, and Başakşehir isn't really tied to that model, so it can really plan ahead a bit more, and perhaps that will make it a bit of a formidable rival in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of sell themselves as the perfect model for Turkish football, and they say other clubs should model themselves on that format because, yeah, they don't have to hold elections every 2 or 3 years like most clubs. They can afford to think in the longer term, and their accounts are supposed to be a lot more transparent. But I think that's not really an option for most teams. It's good for Başakşehir because they didn't have any fans, they didn't have very many members, they didn't have much debt, so it's easy for them to kind of transfer into this model, whereas someone like Galatasaray or Fenerbahce, they have thousands of members that are used to all the perks and privileges that come with being a member. They have a huge amount of debt, so who is that? Who's going to take on all of that? So yeah, I mean, this season has been really interesting because all the big three, the traditional big three, Besiktas, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, they've all been struggling really, especially Fenerbahce. And part of that is to do with definitely financial problems and financial fair play regulations really starting to bite, and overspending over decades basically that's catching up with them. So Başakşehir has been able to avoid most of these problems. I mean, people are starting to ask questions as well now about, you know, where is their money coming from, because they have all these sponsors that seem a little unusual. Like, they're sponsored by pro-government businesses, which it makes sense. These businesses, they want to be in this circle of power that, you know, links football and politics and business, and they get a huge proportion of the broadcasting revenues as well, even with such a small fan base. So I don't know, people are definitely starting to question them more, and I think there's some concern maybe among fans of the big clubs that they are going to kind of establish this new sort of hegemony over Turkish football. But on the other hand, I don't know, they're quite an old club. They're the oldest, I think they're the oldest team in Europe in terms of their player age, and they have done a similar thing to a lot of other big Turkish clubs in terms of bringing in these kind of aging stars on massively inflated wages. So they're not always behaving that differently to the other clubs. They're not really bringing through that many young players, but we'll have to see. Maybe the recent municipal elections could make a difference to their fate as well, because if the opposition is allowed to take over Istanbul municipality, which it seems like they've won it at the moment, there could be implications for Başakşehir here, because the opposition will be in charge of a lot of public tenders. There'll be a lot of opportunities for them to carve out their own kind of patronage system. Maybe businesses will be less able or willing to support Başakşehir here. And with the financial problems that Turkey's experiencing as well, maybe businesses won't be able to support them to the same extent that they have been. So I don't know, I feel like they will win the league this season, but this might be about as good as it gets for them.
I saw somebody joking the other day about with this opposition winning Istanbul, that Başakşehir can sell like Arda Turan and build a couple of new metro stations. Başakşehir isn't actually owned by the municipality anymore, is it? So
it's owned by, it was transferred to the Ministry of Youth and Sports, and then it was bought out. It's a joint stock company now, and it's owned by, I think it's 8 shareholders. There's people like he's the current culture and tourism minister actually, and he owns like a big company. There's 8 shareholders, all in a kind of similar mold. Most of them seem to be in this like triangle of power that exists in Turkey between business, football and politics.
I've also been struck that despite the fact that they're like running away with the league, and it should be a massive story really, you know, the first time anybody out of the big three, apart from Bursaspor a few years ago, the first time anybody out of the big top three has won the league for years. So in theory, it should be a massive story, but in like media coverage, it's not, I mean, nobody focuses on Başakşehir. Still, the focus is always on the big three because that's where all the fans are. That's where all the focus is. I've been a bit surprised at that.
Probably because they have very, very few real fans, and the big three have, you know, 80% of Turkish fans support one of the big three teams. They're among the biggest kind of social institutions in the country, and they all have other branches of different sports as well. It's not just football. They have like basketball and all kinds of stuff like chess and sailing and stuff like that. And so that's maybe helped Başakşehir a little bit as well, because they broke from the municipality and they're purely a football team, so they don't have to worry about all these other sports. But yeah, in this, the media landscape, the football media landscape in Turkey is like kind of very fevered, and it's often just kind of talking about the big three teams at the expense of all of the other teams, purely because they seem to generate the most, you know, viewers and the most interest from fans.
Now, there have been a lot of reports recently about the parlous state of club finances in Turkey. In particular, the top clubs are reported to be in a huge amount of debt, and this has been building for many years for a number of reasons. I mean, how significant are these club debts, and what do they herald?
They're really significant. I mean, a lot of people think that if it wasn't for the support of the government basically bailing out Turkish football, that every Turkish club would be bankrupt. By support, I mean the government sort of writing off or deferring tax debts, or striving to kind of find sponsorship for the support, leaning on companies to sponsor football. And a lot of people believe that the TV broadcasting revenues have been a little bit inflated by the government. And yeah, this is a long-standing problem related to overspending, just purely because most clubs are member-based associations. They are able to hide their finances to quite a large degree. There's not much transparency. There's a lot of money washing around Turkish football. They're able to take on debt quite easily. Big clubs and small clubs actually have, over the past few decades, just tended to buy aging, overpriced players from abroad. And it's just contributed to a massive debt problem that's only growing every season. And so the revenues of Turkish football have been increased, but they're now dwarfed by the debts by like a scale of 4. In 2000, the combined Turkish Super League debt was around $60 million, and the annual revenues were something like $150 million. And now the debt is something like $2.3 billion. And Fenerbahce's debt is something like $621 billion. And so the clubs are often struggling to kind of even service the interest on this debt. And quite a lot of the smaller teams have gone bankrupt in recent seasons, or they've just kind of plummeted down the league. And that's why you can see maybe in the second or third tiers of Turkish football, you can see teams on kind of like minus 15 points because they've just been given so many financial penalties. Now, I don't know. Now, UEFA is really starting to take an interest in Turkish football, and the financial fair play regulations are kind of starting to impact the teams as well, because they're not able to just find money or spend their way out of this as easily as before. And UEFA was saying in 2017, basically every European country had improved in financial terms, but Turkey was the only country where the debts and liabilities are bigger than club assets. So it's quite serious. People are always predicting the end of Turkish football or the collapse of Turkish football, but it always seems to keep going. Early this year, the government announced a raft of measures that are supposed to make the clubs more accountable and to control their spending and get it in line with revenue. So we'll see what happens, but it's probably in its worst ever financial state at the moment.
Yeah, when the government made that announcement, there was a bit of speculation that it would be trying to use this situation to sort of bring the major clubs under further control. Do you think that's realistic, or just wild speculation?
It could be. We'll just have to see how it plays out, really. I mean, I don't get the feeling that anyone thinks these controls are going to be rigorously or seriously applied, because when you start to control football clubs, or it looks like the authorities or the government are controlling them, they become very unpopular with the fans. And I think a lot of fans know that, on the one hand, they know that their clubs are in a bad situation financially, but on the other hand, there's a bit of cognitive dissonance, because they're constantly calling for them to sign new players as well. And anything that gets in the way of that tends to trigger a lot of anger. And that's one of the reasons why presidents, when they hope to win elections every couple of years or every 3 years, they end up spending a lot of money and trying to bring in players to kind of appease the fans. And I mean, some people said that these measures were maybe aimed almost at the municipal elections as well. It's a way to kind of reassure fans that the government is not going to let clubs destroy themselves, because although there were all these kind of measures in place to control their spending, there was also basically a bailout attached to it. So there was a large sum of money that's been given to the clubs, and they will pay that back over a much longer period of time. So it's kind of costing the Turkish taxpayer money, because a lot of this is public funds, but at the same time, it's to reassure the fans that they're not going to let these clubs collapse.
And you mentioned there, Fenerbahce is one of the clubs that's under a huge amount of debt. And last year, they elected a new president, Ali Koç. And around that time, there was all this fevered talk about how this was a very symbolic moment. Ali Koç was a very prominent, very wealthy, the son of a business dynasty, really, who would revolutionize that club. And even it would be a new dawn for Turkey, because he was seen as this sort of symbolic, secular kind of character, very suave and with blue eyes and whatnot. And he'd taken over from an old president of Fenerbahce, who'd been there for years. Fenerbahce's finances are in an absolute shambles, and the club is struggling badly on the pitch this season. They're almost getting relegated. So that whole Ali Koç thing has not really happened. I don't know, it seemed like a bit of a sort of morality tale there in the struggles of Ali Koç in his first season of three as the president of Fenerbahce, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, he came in with a lot of excitement, and he obviously defeated Aziz Yildirim, who'd been president of Fenerbahce for 20 years, which is a huge amount of time for any club president in Turkey. So he came in with, all this kind of glamour and a lot of symbolism, and people became very kind of giddy, and it was almost religious fervor among some people. But he kind of came in saying he really wanted to change the way that Turkish football, or the way that Fenerbahce is run, and that he would hope to have an influence on the rest of Turkish football, because normally the presidents are kind of whipping up hysteria and trying to fight each other, arguing with each other, claiming all these conspiracies are going on. And he kind of promised to bring in a new style of presidency, and that he wasn't going to just carry on the kind of practices that landed the club in $621 million of debt. So it's early days, though. I mean, it's been 9 months, and it's difficult to take over a club like that that's been run by such a dominant figure over 20 years. So he was always speaking, Ali Koç was speaking during his election campaigns about this being a long-term project, that he wanted to reorient the club towards developing young talent, and they have bought quite a few young players. But at the same time, they've kind of been doing similar transfers, really. They've been buying or loaning aging players who are not really performing and who command massive salaries, and they're getting themselves presumably into deeper debt. So I don't know, I kind of feel like he came in promising all of this stuff. He also promised a massive kind of sponsorship bonanza for Fenerbahce using his contacts in business and stuff like that. And I feel like a lot of people were actually a lot more excited about this potential funding than they were for, you know, these kind of long-term youth academies and development projects. So we'll see. He only has a 3-year term, and he's already almost a year through it. So I think you have to be successful in Turkish football. I think the fans will tolerate this season maybe as a kind of transition, although a lot of them are really already really angry, and there's plenty of them have already been calling for him to go. Unless he delivers something next season, I think he's going to be in a lot of trouble, and he could easily lose the next election.
Actually, one of the players that they've loaned, just incidentally, is Islam Slimani from Leicester. That's my hometown club, and he was an absolute flop at Leicester, and he's been a flop at Fenerbahce, I think, hasn't he?
That's exactly who I had in mind when I was saying they kind of continued the practices of the previous administration in signing these really mediocre players. I don't really understand why they signed him, because, he's been terrible at Leicester. He doesn't seem to score goals or have any pace. So I can't really understand that, because, he's on loan, but they're paying him a huge salary. I think it's more than 4 million euros a year. I think he's got 2 Super League goals this season.
One of the other things I want to talk to about while you're on the line here is this question of African migrant footballers, because you've got a whole chapter in the book about this issue. We actually talked about this question on the podcast recently, and you spent a while, I believe, in Ferikoy at the pitch there, where this African Cup is played, and scouts from various Turkish clubs come along to look for players. I mean, just talk about that chapter, sketch out that whole situation. There's some quite sad stories, really, of people who've come over from Africa. They have these big dreams of becoming professional players, moving to Europe, getting picked up by one of the big clubs, and almost always that doesn't happen, and they get sort of stranded in Istanbul.
Yeah, well, there's every May and June in Istanbul, there's a competition called the African Nations Cup, and it's run by an African football association in Istanbul. And it's to basically help out this huge number of players that are coming from countries like Ghana and Nigeria and Cameroon, looking to build a career in football and looking to use Turkey as a country, as a kind of stepping stone into a career at a European club. And so over the past decade and a half, the numbers of African players is coming to Turkey to play football as soared. Often they are brought over by unscrupulous agents. Their agents could be Turkish, African, European. They often made promises about trials and clubs that they're going to be signed for. Often the promises are quite extravagant, that they're going to be signed for Fenerbahce and stuff like that. And often these players will use all of their family's kind of money and savings, or their family will sell a lot of their possessions or property to fund them coming to Turkey, because they think they're going to be coming here and playing for a big club and earning a huge amount of money. But often when they end up here, the agent disappears with the money, or the trials are not really serious, or they're kind of abandoned after a few weeks by the agent. So a lot of them end up kind of stranded here, really. And that's one of the reasons behind this African Nations tournament. It's a way for these players to impress coaches and impress scouts and try and get signed. Because, yeah, very, very few of them will get signed for a big club, but there's a huge footballing network of kind of amateur and semi-professional clubs in Turkey, and lots of them, if they're decent, lots of them will get contracts with these clubs, and they can earn something like $8,000 a season, which is not that much money, but for a lot of them it's a lot more than they would be earning back home. But yeah, there's a lot of sad stories there. There's a lot of people that they were abandoned by their agents, and they didn't realize that they needed to apply to extend their visas, and then their visa ran out and they ended up being stuck in Turkey, you know, working in kind of illegal menial jobs and not even being able to sign for clubs when teams want to sign them because of their visa status, and they're not able to go home because, first of all, they can't really afford the journey, and also because their whole family is depending on them, and they can't really go back and say that they've failed. So yeah, it's quite a desperate situation for a lot of these players. They end up living in poverty. They end up just desperately trying to save up enough money in these jobs where they're often exploited and not paid properly, and just so that they can save up enough money to take the time to train in time for the transfer window and hopefully get an opportunity at a club. But it doesn't work out for a lot of them.
Now, just to conclude, I mean, what could you just talk about what's in the pipeline for you? I mean, you're still based in Turkey, I believe. What are you working on at the moment? Are there any more books in the pipeline?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, really. I think I'd love to write more books, but I'm at a bit of a crossroads at the moment. I could write something more along football lines, or I could go into a kind of different direction in terms of Turkey. I think I'm finished at the moment with Turkish football. I'm going to see what happens. I'm working on a few different stories, including some video stories as well. I'm interested in writing about music, actually, in Turkey, and that's something, another area that I think has been a little bit neglected, and the politics of Turkish music. So we'll see. But at the moment, I'm still enjoying living in Turkey and writing plenty of stories. I just wrote a story about Turkey's first female professional boxer. That was a great story. I really enjoyed working on that. And I went to Belgium to watch her fight. So yeah, there's plenty of stories in Turkey. So we'll see.
That was Patrick Keddy. Many thanks to him. As I mentioned earlier, if you're interested in the subject, also check out the episode that we did last year with John McManus discussing his book about Turkish football called Welcome to Hell, In Search of the Real Turkish Football. Patrick Keddy's book is included in the generous deal offered by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury, giving Turkey Book Talk members 35% off the cover price of over 400 books in their Turkey Ottoman History series. If you sign up as a member, you also get transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview when it's published, transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 80 conversations so far, and access to an archive of 231 book reviews written by me, covering Turkish history, politics, literature, and various other things. To become a member and support the podcast, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.